Well, we are going to be back in the disciples study, and it's not up here, but we're actually in Andrew today. So in the notes, push this up. Okay, except it'll pop when I turn my head down, but I'll try not to. All right, so we're going to be in the notes on Andrew today, and the nice thing about the rest of these disciples, for the most part, there aren't very many passages for each one. For Peter could be a study of his own. I mean, we could spend the whole summer just talking about Peter and going through all of those passages. A principle that I apply, I was taught to apply this, but I think it's a good one, is when you have fewer passages, they probably carry more weight on what they're describing or what they're saying. I do this when I'm doing word studies as well. If a word only occurs a few times, where it occurs is probably important, as opposed to a very common word. And for Peter, we have a lot of passages, and it's not that they are insignificant, but you have to piece all of those together to get the whole picture. With someone like Andrew, we only have three passages. All three of them are in John's gospel. And there's one thing that it seems to be the case is that, certainly from the connection with Zebedee, is that Andrew and John knew each other fairly well. They're both the younger brothers, it seems. So Peter and Andrew, James and John. We're also going to find in this one passage that Andrew and John do have some sort of connection because they're joined together at least early on in Jesus' ministry. So Andrew is one of those that stays behind the scenes. But I've titled him the behind-the-scenes evangelist because every time we see him, he's bringing someone to Christ in every single case, even though there are only the three passages. But as I said, I would put more weight on fewer passages than I would on many passages, unless you have just a huge number and they're all about the same thing. Now, it is fascinating. If it weren't for John, we wouldn't have this study this summer. I can tell you that right now. I would just have names, and that's it. John is the one that's going to provide all of the information for all of these other disciples. And that tells me something also about John. I know he's one in the study, but he seems to be interested in the disciples themselves, a little more so than the other gospel writers. Now, certainly Matthew was also one of the disciples. I'm sure, have some eyewitnesses of other disciples through Luke, but the thing is that it's John who really wants us to know about these men. And so if it weren't for him, I couldn't do much of this study. I would just have names. And then generally speaking, I would just say, well, the disciples in general. What you want to look for, and we'll see this, I might be able to get into James today as well. But when we get to James, it's going to be interesting. No, not just James. There's one here, too, where I'll look at all of the different Gospels. It's interesting how the other Gospel writers will often just say the disciples in general. And then John will make the exception and say, yes, but this one didn't go with the rest of them. In other words, separating them out. So there are some interesting characteristics there. Okay, so about Andrew, he is part of the inner circle of four. Many people will refer to the disciples in three different groups, and I have that on the first page of the study. But the three groups, and it seems that the three groups are significant in that the first group would be early in terms of Jesus calling them and setting them apart as not just disciples, but apostles as well. And just to recall, disciple means student, or one who's following, one who's studying, whereas apostle means one who is sent. So the ones that he is entrusting with his message And with the miracles, they are the 12. And so the inner circle of four includes Andrew, but the problem is when we see activities, major activities, like the Transfiguration, Andrew's not a part of that. The other three are. So these terms that are used here, the circle of four and the intimate three, these are what scholars will use to describe them. But essentially, you have the four, but then Andrew is kind of out here instead of in the inner the innermost circle. But he is working behind the scenes, and often he is upstaged by Peter. Once Peter comes on the scene, Peter's the one who does the talking, he's the one who does the leading, the older brother, you know, but he seems to be the one that kind of takes charge. I'm going to suggest that with James and John, you might have a similar dynamic, because often James and John are paired together when they're speaking, but it's possible James is the one that's leading that charge. And later in the church, in the church at Jerusalem, later on, after the resurrection and ascension, James is going to take a major role in leading that church. So, anyhow, let's continue on with his appearances. We're going to start in John chapter 1, and I want us to look at John chapter 1, and we will look at beginning at verse 35. I've avoided these texts even though they include some of the things that we've already said. For example, Simon Peter is going to be included in this passage. But I want us to look now, kind of focus your attention on Andrew specifically. Let me go ahead and read the passage, and then we'll talk about it. Verse 35, the next day again, John was standing with two of his disciples, and he looked at Jesus as he walked by and said, "Behold the Lamb of God." Now, by the way, that John is John the Baptist. You could back up and find that out. I mean, this, I know we have more than one John, but John the Baptist. The chances are with the two disciples, one of them is going to be identified as Andrew. The other one, the unnamed one, most likely John. That is the Apostle John. The two disciples heard him say this, and they followed Jesus. Jesus turned and saw them following and said to them, "What are you seeking?" And they said to him, "Rabbi," which means teacher, "where are you staying?" He said to them, "Come and you will see." And they came. So they came and saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him that day, for it was about the 10th hour. One of the two who heard John speak and followed Jesus was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. He first found his own brother Simon and said to him, "We have found the Messiah," which means Christ. He brought him to Jesus. Jesus looked at him and said, "You are Simon, the son of John. You shall be called Cephas," which means Peter. Now, everyone focuses their attention on Peter, of course, because that's our focus of attention. But in this passage, Andrew is singled out as the one who brings his brother to Jesus. With all the other gospel accounts, if I did not have John, all the other gospel accounts, it sounds like Jesus is just walking by the shore. He sees Peter. He gets into the, you know, the boat, the fish, you know, all of that initial miracle. John is giving us a detail that he feels is important. Andrew's the one who brought his brother. Peter didn't come to Jesus on his own. That first encounter with Jesus and Peter with the boat and the fish is probably not a first encounter. All right? According to John, it seems that there's something else going on behind the scenes. And the other thing is the fact that Jesus would single out Peter, go to him, tells me that Peter is not necessarily willingly coming to Jesus even after his brother talks about him. So his brother, Andrew, stands out here. And I think that John wants him to stand out. He wants him to be known as the one who brings Peter to Jesus. So this is one of the passages where it seems that he is bringing someone to Jesus, and a very important someone, his brother. Now, I also want you to notice something else, because this is going to happen in the next passage as well. And I've got it in the notes, I think, somewhere. Where did I put it? Yes, upstaged by Peter, known as Peter's brother. Now, I grew up in a house, my mom can attest to this. My dad was a musician, usually well-known, always in the spotlight, and I never liked the spotlight, so it didn't bother me, but his name was Bob, and so I was always Bob's son, and she was Bob's wife. But we know how that works when you have someone who's a little larger than life or more prominent, or maybe in Peter's case, more talkative. Everyone knows Peter, but then there's Andrew. Well, who's Andrew? Well, that's Simon Peter's brother. You know, that's the brother. And notice again that John likes to put the two names together, Simon and Peter, rather than just Peter. In a few cases, he does that, but not here. So what do we know about Andrew here? Well, the other thing is, if the two disciples are John the Apostle and Andrew, that means that they have some kind of relationship, which would make sense. They're working in the same industry. Zebedee is the one who owns the business. We'll find that out. There's a little passage in Mark that lets us know about that. But Zebedee is the one who owns the business. All four of these are working for them, but two of them are the sons. So anyhow, just to get that in our minds. So what other characteristics can we find here? Well, all we really have is verse 40, where one of the two who heard John speak followed Jesus was Andrew. That also might be a little jab at Peter as well, or for those who put Peter in the prominent position, and that is, just know, Andrew followed Jesus before Peter did. He came to him first. And also, there's the John the Baptist connection, which is another thing that we don't have with the other Gospels. Now, we do have mention that John the Baptist is handing over to Jesus his disciples, but in this case, we have specific ones. So Andrew and John most likely were followers of John the Baptist. So all that you know about John the Baptist, which in John chapter 1, you'd have to read, he really emphasizes John the Baptist and his ministry. Remember, John is coming from the top down, so from heaven's perspective down to earth, whereas the others are working from the bottom up. But in John's case, John the Baptist is the one who witnesses to the Word made flesh. And that's the important part. Okay, I know that's not much of a text, but it's enough to give us a little indication. Now, the next one I want to do something with. So we're actually going to go to a couple other passages that are not listed on your notes. But I want us to look at this in light of the other places. This is one of the few cases, and there are not very many. You can imagine what the major ones would be. You know, the crucifixion, the ascension, the resurrection. All of those are going to be in all four Gospels because they're important to every single Gospel, regardless of their perspective. This is an event that's also in all four Gospels, and it's the feeding of the 5,000. So let's come back to Matthew first. I want us to look at how Matthew, Mark, and Luke portray this event mainly in light of how Jesus' disciples are reacting to the situation. So Matthew chapter 14 and beginning in verse 13. Matthew 14, and then we'll start in 13. Now I'll try not to stop. I'll read through it, but I want you to pay this attention. I know there are many things going on, and usually when people preach or teach this text, they're focusing on the miracle, which is important. That is the point. However, I want you to focus on the disciples. How are the disciples reacting to this event? Now, when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat. Trying to back up. Oh, yeah, heard about John the Baptist, his life being threatened, and that he was going to be put to death. Okay, so that was it. But anyway, he withdrew from there in a boat to a desolate place by himself. When the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the town. So he's trying to get by himself again, and here's the crowd following him. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them and healed their sick. Now, when it was evening, the disciples came to him and said, "This is a desolate place, and the day is now over. Send the crowds away to go into the villages and buy food for themselves." But Jesus said, "They need not go away. You give them something to eat." They said to him, "We have only 5 loaves here and 2 fish. And he said, "Bring them here to me." Now, I'm going to stop there because you know the miracle. If you don't, read on. But anyhow, yeah, the miracle of the fish and the bread. But I want you to notice their reaction. "We have only 5 loaves here and 2 fish. From Matthew's perspective, you don't know how they know that. Okay, so keep that in mind. Also, the word "only" is in the Greek, and that is a word that emphasizes this is all we have. Not seeing that this is significant, it's like this is insignificant. We don't have enough. Let them buy their own food. Okay, next passage is Mark 6. So in Mark 6, beginning in verse 32. "And they went away in the boat to a desolate place by themselves. Now many saw them going and recognized them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. When he went ashore, he saw a great crowd, and he had compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd." It's always fascinating to me the details in each one, but we won't go into all those. "And he began to teach them many things. And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, 'This is a desolate place, and the hour is now late. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and buy themselves something to eat.' But he answered them, 'You give them something to eat.' And they said to him, 'Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat?'" It doesn't say who said that. I have my suspicion. Judas, possibly. Thinking about the money, of course, but I don't know. It's not there, so speculation only. "And he said to them, 'How many loaves do you have? Go and see.' And when they had found out, they said, 5 loaves, and 2 fish. And then the miracle takes place. Sit down on the grass and the miracle, okay? I know I'm avoiding the miracle, but I want you to notice, again, the disciples as a whole are questioning what's going on. Send them into town. Have them buy their own food. And notice that this is going to be important for the John passage. "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." And when they had found out. That little section right there, we're going to find out who finds that out. All right, come to Luke. Luke chapter 9. You know, Luke chapter 9 is going to pop up again and again and again in this study. When we get to John, it's going to be prominent. But Luke chapter 9 and verse 10, we're going to have the same event. So 9 and 10. "On their return, the apostles told him all they had done." We'll come back to this passage when we talk about James and John. "And he took them and withdrew apart to a town called Bethsaida. When the crowds learned it, they followed him, and he welcomed them and spoke to them of the kingdom of God and cured those who had need of healing. Now the day began to wear away, and the 12 came and said to him, 'Send the crowd away to go into the surrounding villages and countryside to find lodging and get provisions, for we are here in a desolate place.'" Now here's what I find fascinating. The 12, that should be all of them. Okay? John will make a slight adjustment. Luke is most likely using Peter as his source for a lot of this. We have a lot of reasons to think that. He said to them, "You give them something to eat." And they said, "We have no more," notice the phrasing, "we have no more than 5 loaves and 2 fish, unless we are to go and buy food for all these people." Now, we had the money tabulation in the last passage. But so the issue is that the disciples as a whole, if all you have is are Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you are just thinking all the disciples just lacked faith on this one. And that once again, they don't know what Jesus is doing. Let's get the crowds something else. And there's probably an element of sarcasm, unless we are to go and buy food. Maybe the sarcasm is coming from Judas. I'm not sure. But there's some sarcasm there. Do you expect us to go and buy all of these people? 5,000 people. We're going to buy them all food. So now. Let's come to the passage we really want to look into, and that is John chapter 6. And really, it's 8 and 9, but let me look at that again. Let's see. Yeah. Yes. Actually, we'll back up to kind of the beginning of the chapter, chapter 6. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias, and a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing on the sick. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. That might have some significance too, what the Passover represents, the provision of God for his people before they leave. Lifting up his eyes then and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" He said this to test him. Now we'll get to Philip later, for he himself knew what he would do. He knows him well already. Philip answered him, it is Philip who says this. I should have looked more carefully. I was thinking Judas. Okay, well, Judas might have told Philip. No, not really. 200 denarii worth of bread would not be enough for each of them to get a little. One of his disciples, Andrew, notice he's once again called Simon Peter's brother. And I don't think John's doing that for his own benefit. He's doing it because his readers don't know much about Andrew. Okay? If you're wondering who he is, yes, he's there, and he's Simon Peter's brother. And he said to him, this is Andrew speaking, "There is a boy here who has 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, but what are they for so many?" Now, I realize there still is the little bit of, there's skepticism there, but I want you to notice the way this is worded compared to all of the other disciples saying, "What do you expect us to do? Go into town? Why don't we have them go back to town? Have them buy their own food?" No, Andrew is the one that actually finds the boy. So how is it that the disciples know that this is what they have? It's because of Andrew. That's subtle, but remember, fewer passages, probably more weight on those passages. And the fact that John is specifically zeroing in on Andrew with this one, he zeroes in on Philip as well. And again, Philip, I guess, is the one that came up with the money idea, but it is Andrew that's the focus here in this passage. And so he says that, and Jesus said, "Have the people sit down," and so on, the rest of the miracle. I know it's subtle. I know it's one verse. It's not much to go on. But the fact that there is a separation between what the rest of the disciples are saying and what Andrew is doing is telling. And that Andrew is doing it without fanfare, without spotlight. He finds the boy. He finds the food, and then he brings him to Jesus. And yes, he says, "But what are these for so many?" But that is a much different response than to say, "This is all we have. Let them go find their own food." Andrew is not put in that category, okay? He probably is going along with it because the others are speaking. But anyway, just note that, okay? A little bit of a shift there. All right, the last passage with Andrew is going to be John 12. And here's where the evangelist side, I think, comes out. In John 12, and beginning in verse 20. Now, one thing I want you to, again, if you spend your time reading these Gospels, you'll see. The disciples have a difficult time trying to figure out what Jesus is doing, where he's going. They're not even sure what he's talking about with the suffering and the death. That's a confusion for them. But also, they are not sure what category of person would make a disciple. Okay, they're thinking like most Jews would have thought in that day, this is for Israel, this is for the Jewish nation. Even though they don't have a nation, they're subsumed under the Gentiles, it's for the Jews. And so we will see that emphasis. It's not for the Samaritans, which is funny because the Samaritans are part of that northern kingdom, what the remnants of it, but they're also only worshiping God through Moses. They have nothing to do with David. So the Samaritans are outsiders to them. We'll see that when we get to the James and John discussion. Here, if you want an outsider, here you go. Greeks. Greeks are outsiders, for sure. Even Greek-speaking Jews would be outsiders to those who are speaking Aramaic and, you know, Hebrew being a major part of their tradition. So now among those who went up to worship at the feast were some Greeks. So these came to Philip. Again, we'll bring up Philip a little later because he has a connection with Greeks, apparently, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee and asked him, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Now, here's the part, pay close attention. Philip went and told Andrew. Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus. This is subtle, but I want you to notice Philip doesn't just tell Jesus on his own. I don't think it's because Philip wouldn't talk to Jesus. We just saw him doing that earlier. Andrew is part of the inner four. I mean, he is part of that group. But also, what is significant about Andrew? Why didn't he go to James or John? We'll find that out. Oh, there are some Greeks who want to talk to Jesus. Well, tell them to go away. Get rid of them. I'll call fire on them too, you know, whatever. No, with Andrew, he knows that he has an ear, that he will listen to these outsiders wanting to know about Jesus. He understands that. Philip is a part of it. But I'm fascinated by the fact that Andrew's the one that he goes to. And Jesus answered them and so on. He goes on, the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. And then, yeah, his teaching continues. But just that little bit, just that little bit. I know that's not much to go on. And we're going to get into passages, well, some disciples, where all we have is their name. So there's not going to be a whole lot for many of them. But for Andrew, I don't want us neglecting him. I don't want us to just kind of brush over him. I don't want us thinking about him as just Simon Peter's brother. It seems that John wants more. He wants us to understand more. I've got some information in the notes on his role. Without Andrew, Peter most likely would not have known Jesus. Now, I'm getting this from some others like A.B. Bruce and John MacArthur, but you know, that's speculative, but it's obvious that Andrew had a part in bringing Peter to Jesus. Long before Peter's confession, Andrew made his own. This is Messiah. I mean, he making that clear. He was the first of the disciples to include Gentiles. You know that that passage that we just read is the first evidence of any Gentiles involved. And, you know, they have a different way of identifying Greek-speaking Jews. They usually will call those Hellenists or something. That's a different term. This is actual Greeks. Okay, so those are Gentiles. Those are the outsiders. His faith was the strongest. That could probably be debated, but I will say His faith seems incredibly strong in comparison to the rest of the disciples. And then Andrew teaches us that in ministry, humility is greater than position. Oh, that's going to be a major part of James and John. What position do we have in the kingdom? Who's going to pay attention to us? You know, I don't want to do this good work unless somebody knows I'm doing it. Andrew is the behind the scenes and really a picture of how we as disciples should be, because as disciples, we are to be exalting Christ and not ourselves. We should not be the ones that are the focal point. It worries me, it honestly does, in the years that I've been teaching, when students will say, I really like your teaching, I really, you know, and they shower me with way too many encouragements, and I know I call them encouragements, but, you know, you're prepping me for something that I don't need. What I want you to remember, if you don't ever remember me, remember him. I'm supposed to be pointing to him in everything that I'm doing, and he should be the focal point. Andrew knew how to do that. If we can't learn anything else from him, let's at least learn that. And humility is a characteristic of Christ. The others would develop it, you know, but they're not there. Andrew's there from the beginning. I have a quote from a man named Daniel McLean. Now, I think I got this from John MacArthur, but he didn't give me the information. I had to hunt this down to figure out who is Daniel McLean. Scottish Presbyterian minister from the late 19th century going into the early 20th, but also a scholar. He wrote a work in 1904. It's a long title, but it's essentially a study on the disciples. It's a monologue with Nicodemus, Barnabas. I mean, it adds a bunch of other people too, but anyhow, it was a study on them. So one of the earliest studies. When he gets to Andrew, this is his comment, all right? Gathering together the traces of character found in Scripture about Andrew, we have neither the writer of an epistle, nor the founder of a church, nor a leading figure in the apostolic age, but simply an intimate disciple of Jesus Christ, ever anxious that others should know the spring of spiritual joy and share the blessing he so highly prized. A man of very moderate endowment who scarcely redeemed his early dramatic power or heroic spirit, yet with that clinging confidence in Christ that brought him into that inner circle of the 12. A man of deep religious feeling with little power of expression, magnetic more than electric. I like that description. Better suited for the quiet walks of life than the stirring thoroughfares. Andrew is the apostle of private life, the disciple of the hearth. I think that's a good description. That's actually more words about Andrew than the Bible has, but still, it's drawing from that. So I don't want us to forget Andrew, okay? He will get lost in the shuffle. If we didn't have John's gospel, he would definitely get lost in the shuffle. You wouldn't even know him other than his name and just that he's listed with them. All right, I have a little bit of time to dive into James and John. And it's good because I want to contrast what we just learned from Andrew with these two. And that we're still in the inner circle. So Peter and Andrew, brothers, James and John, brothers. But James and John, brothers, sons of Zebedee, who is the owner of the fishing business. Okay, it's his business. How do I know that? Actually, it's Mark 1:20. It gives us that little detail. Let me pull that up real quickly. You don't have to flip to it. It's just immediately, this was the James and John, their call. I'll just say this. This is the Jesus by the Sea of Galilee, and he says, I will make you fishers of men. He saw Simon and Andrew casting their nets. Jesus said, follow me, I will make you fishers of men. And immediately they left their nets and followed him. And going a little farther, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and John, his brother, who were in their boat mending the nets. And immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and followed him. Now, I know for us, it's like hired servants. Oh, people have employees. Not in most of these fishing businesses in that area. And this is what we would call like blue collar area. And people are not going to have hired servants as much. Yeah. I'm going to talk about that when we get to the end of the study. In fact, what I want to do, now it's all tradition, we don't have in Scripture. I do have, in fact, it's in the notes, it's at the end. A lot of it's from Fox's Book of Martyrs, but it gives us some of the background of what happened to them later. I want to do that with all of them, and we'll do it together, you know, when we get to the end. So here we just see that there are hired servants. This is telling me that there's some wealth here, and also, you know, in another passage, I think we've already covered it, is that Peter and Andrew are working for Zebedee. So that's where the connection is. Now, sons of thunder. This is an interesting way to describe somebody, and it's Jesus' own title. So in Mark 3:17, same passage or same gospel, but 3:17. I want you to notice when we have the list of the disciples, James the son of Zebedee and John the brother of James. By the way, there tells me again, it's not just Peter or it's not just Andrew who has the Simon Peter's brother title, but it's, oh yeah, this is John, James's brother. You know James. Yeah, okay, that's his brother. To whom he gave the name Boanerges, that is the sons of thunder. In Aramaic, it's B'nai Ragash, which is just sons of thunder. But anyhow, this is just the kind of the Greek version of that. So Jesus himself gave him that title. So that's not just everyone else looking at them and saying, oh, yeah, the sons of thunder. No, he actually nicknames them. Seems like Jesus is going around giving names to people. You know, I'm going to call you Rock. Okay. Everybody else is looking at him. And then I'm calling you sons of thunder. Yeah. Okay. So that's Jesus doing that. Now, I think we'll have time for one passage. I want you to look. I've separated them out, but this is very difficult with these two. Because when you see James in the Gospels, you always see James and John together. But I have the indication that James might be more the leader and John just the one that's with him. But still, you see them together. We're going to be able to separate John out pretty easily, because he wrote a gospel. You know, we have a lot about John. With James, it's hard for me to just isolate James. I will put them together as sons of thunder, and you'll see the characteristics. What's going to be important about that is that if James and John are both involved in some of these events, then what that means is John has those characteristics too. Okay, so they're together. Now, Luke 9 is one of the most fascinating chapters in the study of the disciples that I have. If we could go through, well, I've been through Luke with many of you from years ago, but anyway, if we could go through the whole chapter, but it's 62 verses, I don't have time to go through all that now, but we're going to look at 51 through 56. However, I want to back up a little bit. Let me get this first. It's like walking and chewing gum trying to do this. Okay. So we're going to look at the 51 through 56, and you'll know the text, I think. But I want you to see how Luke arranges everything around it. Many have assumed, actually, from study and looking at the other Gospels, Luke is not strictly chronological always. I know he says he's putting everything in order, but order doesn't have to mean chronological order. There are other ways to arrange things. This chapter is incredibly significant on discipleship. If you want a chapter in your Gospels that deals with discipleship to the fullest extent, including good as well as bad examples, this is it. If we back up far enough, let me find the passage here. Yes, 23, we've looked at this already. Back up to verse 23, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. Luke's the one who adds daily in that. But now, notice, from that point forward in this chapter, there is a focus on how people are responding to Jesus and what discipleship means. Why do I say that? Come down to verse 37. This is the lead-in for the passage we're looking at. On the next day when they came down from the mountain, a great crowd met them. Behold, a man cried out, "Teacher, I beg you to look at my son, for he is an only child." There's going to be an actual miracle here, but I want you to notice this. Behold, a spirit seizes him, and he suddenly cries out. It convulses him so that he foams at the mouth and shatters him and will hardly leave him. Here's the verse. And I begged your disciples to cast it out, but they could not. Ooh. The disciples are supposed to have that power to be able to do that. But there's also a critical thing about discipleship, and that is it has to be God's power, not your own. So I don't know what's going on. I do know Jesus' reaction. Notice the reaction. "O faithless and twisted generation, how long am I to be with you and bear with you? Bring your son here." Now, some I've heard preach and teach this as he's looking at all the crowds. Well, what just happened is the disciples couldn't exorcise this demon. And yet, when Jesus responds, I think he's speaking especially to the disciples. There might be others involved, but that's the disciples. Why couldn't you do this? Where's your faith? How long am I to be with you? This is so critical because Jesus is leaving. At a certain point, he's leaving, and whatever power they have is going to remain with them so that they become the hands, the feet of Jesus. And here they can't do what he's asked them to do. So he seems actually quite upset here. There are times when Jesus gets mad. This is one of them. And so, of course, Jesus, when he speaks to his disciples, he does rebuke the unclean spirit, heals him. Look at 43. "And all were astonished at the majesty of God, but while they were all marveling at everything he was doing, Jesus said to his disciples, 'Let these words sink into your ears. The Son of Man is about to be delivered into the hands of men.'" Now, how does that connect with what just happened? He's not going to be with them indefinitely. They have to take charge. I mean, they have to actually follow his example, which is letting the power of God work within them. So he says this, but notice what it says here. This is in Luke, so probably Peter's perspective, or I don't know, the other disciples would have been able to say this too. "They did not understand this saying, and it was concealed from them, so that they might not perceive it." That's a sermon in itself. Jesus God hiding understanding from people. "And they were afraid to ask him." Now, we're going to get to this. "An argument arose among them as to which of them was the greatest." Notice how Luke weaves these things together. We just had, "If anyone comes after me, take up his cross, you know, follow me." Basically, humility is the issue. The issue is understanding that you are a servant of God, but now they're worrying about who's the greatest. We just had a miracle where they couldn't even do what they were supposed to do. And now all of a sudden, you know, they're arguing over this. Humanity. What can I say? We're all there. I'm not saying this is just them. We like to pick on them, but I say this with ancient Israel too. Gripe about ancient Israel all you want. Realize the same sin nature's in you. Okay. But anyway, Jesus, knowing the reasoning of their hearts, took a child and put him by his side and said to them, "Whoever receives this child in my name receives me." You need to be like a child. And not a child in terms of your understanding and your maturity, but in terms of your faith, in terms of your willingness to just accept what I've given to you instead of grasping for more when you don't have it. You're no better than Jacob in the Old Testament, that when he was given the blessings and all of that and knew that he was going to be the leader between Esau and him, he went and grabbed it for himself. He did not wait, didn't wait on the Lord. So this is a real strong text when you put it all together. And now look at verse 49. John answered, "Master, we saw someone casting out demons in your name." We'll probably revisit this next week, but, "and we tried to stop him." Someone else is casting out demons. Now realize what we just went through. This is why I don't like breaking up text too much. When you look at the whole context, the disciples could not cast out demons, but we found this person who's casting out demons in your name, and we tried to stop them. Well, why are you trying to stop them? That's what you're supposed to be doing. I sense a little jealousy here. "And Jesus said, don't stop them, for the one who is not against you is for you." You know what that's telling me? This is Luke's gospel. If you won't do it, I'll find someone who will. And by the way, that's a major theme in Luke. If you Jewish leaders aren't going to accept the kingdom that I'm offering you, I'll find someone who will. And it won't be anybody that you would accept normally. All right, yes. So now we're in verse 41. "When the days drew near for him to be taken up, he set his face to go to Jerusalem." By the way, this is also a key chapter in Luke. We call it the journey to Jerusalem. It's the longest section in Luke. His journey to Jerusalem takes a very long time, and all of the details that we have, all the way until he gets to Jerusalem towards the end of the gospel, it starts here. "And he sent messengers ahead of him who went and entered a village of the Samaritans." Now, I told you about them. They're kind of outsiders, remnants of the northern kingdom, but they only are looking to Moses and his writings. They don't accept David and his dynasty. "So to make preparations for him, but the people did not receive him because his face was set toward Jerusalem." Why would the Samaritans reject him because he's going to Jerusalem? Because they don't recognize Jerusalem. They have Mount Gerizim. They have their place of worship. There's a separation between Jews and Samaritans. Look at John 4 and the woman at the well. There's a separation between them. The moment they hear Jerusalem, they're like, well, we're not going to be a part of that. You know, you're not the Messiah we're looking for, because they're not looking for a king. They're looking for a prophet like Moses. I realize he's both, but I mean, for them, prophet like Moses, not Davidic king. So it makes sense why they're rejecting him. "And when his disciples," and notice they're named, "James and John saw it, they said," this is so great, "Lord, do you want us to tell fire to come down from heaven and consume them?" Wait a minute, you couldn't cast out demons, and now you think you can call down fire? That's Sodom and Gomorrah talk. You know, that we'll judge them all. "But he turned and rebuked them." Oh, I wish that we had the words. We don't. "And they went on to another village." Now, that's the sons of thunder. Good example of it. And it's both James and John. And how do I know John's a part of it? Because John's the one that's singled out in verse 49 as the one who says, "We saw people casting out demons in your name." So this will enter us into the next phase, which will be James and John. Next week, we'll talk about James. We've got another passage. James and John's mother gets involved. Anyway, we have all of that. But I want you to see the contrast, because we just talked about Andrew. Look at the contrast between Andrew and these sons of thunder. Just look at the contrast. If you're wanting to know, be like this one and not like these, that's as good of an example as any. And also, when Jesus starts showing some anger or frustration towards his disciples, pay close attention to what's going on. This whole chapter, if you want a chapter that's all about discipleship, what's the next passage? someone comes to him and says, I'll follow you wherever you go, and foxes of the have holes, birds of the air have nests, Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. I mean, the whole thing is about discipleship, the whole chapter. And it's discipleship in the context of Jesus going to Jerusalem to be put to death. Take up your cross and follow me. They don't get the humiliation, the shame, the sacrifice that that's requiring. They don't get that. But Andrew strangely gets something. Okay, that's good. If you want to have any comments, questions.
I wonder if Andrew